Sarah and Catherine have a very specific request of you. We're fairly far advanced in our work on impairment. I think we've discussed it with you in the past, but we have a particular issue which is about, well, I'll let Catherine and Sarah describe it. So we're particularly looking for your views because it very much relates to presentation disclosure. Sarah, are you going to?
Yes, thank you. Okay. The agenda paper that we passed out beforehand kind of gives a background of the model and what we're currently developing right now. Just quickly going through the appendix on that, just to give an overview of what the model is without getting into too much detail so we can talk about the presentation issue that we're interested in particularly. We are developing a three-bucket model. Generally speaking, all originated and purchased non-credit impaired assets would start into bucket one and would recognize a 12-month expected loss. When those assets deteriorate, with the threshold that we've designed, then they will move into either bucket two or three, depending on how they're evaluated for impairment. Evaluated as a group will move into bucket two. Evaluated as a individual instrument will move into bucket three. Both buckets two and three will recognize a lifetime expected loss. And for purchased credit impaired assets, those are all going to start into bucket two or three. And recognize, or the lifetime loss will be incorporated into the effective interest rate using a credit-adjusted effective interest rate, and no impairment expense will be recognized on day one. So generally speaking, that's the model that we're going after right now. The question that we're particularly interested in, and we wanted to make sure we spent some time on, is question five within the paper that we sent out. One of the issues that we've been told that users are concerned about is how to compare originated portfolios to purchased portfolios that have kind of the same credit quality. When you perform a business combination, when you bring the assets over, for example, or purchase a portfolio and you bring the assets over, the allowance that was recognized on the seller's books is not moved over with the assets. So people have shared with us that they're concerned about not being able to compare the ratios from the seller's books to the buyer's books, for example. So we're trying to, since we're not bringing the allowance over and no impairment expense will be recognized on day one with these purchased assets, we've been asked to come up with some disclosures that would alleviate this concern with users, and so we're asking for your help to design those disclosures that would help meet the comparability that we've been told you all would like to see. Any questions on that?
So for an originated portfolio, you might have them at par of 100, but if they're credit impaired, there might be an allowance balance of 20, for example. If you were to go out and buy a portfolio that included credit impaired assets, you might buy it for, I don't know, 75. Part of which obviously would then be the fair value, and if it was a business combination, you'd measure the whole thing at fair value. Part of that difference between 100 and 75 might be because of the credit impairment. Part of it could be other factors, such as interest rate changes. But the point is that for the originated portfolio, you will have explicitly an allowance balance of 20. For the purchased portfolio, which is stated at fair value, at the moment, there is an allowance balance of zero. And then you would maybe build an allowance later on if it deteriorates any further. But the complaint is that you can't then compare the adequacy of the allowance very easily when it's 20 for one and zero for the others.
You investigated the possibility, at least on a disclosure basis, of some sort of grossed up presentation. So you say, well, I bought it for 75, Steve's example. Within that, presumably based potentially on some assumptions, but there is a credit allowance of 20 or whatever, so that you could get a sense of how much of that balance sort of would be there.
So why wouldn't we just be told what that it's 100? Why wouldn't we just get what's the contractual gross value of the asset in disclosure?
In disclosure. Well, that's what, so we're, that's what we're asking, if that's what you want.
Yeah. The only way to assess adequacy of provision is to know what the gross contractual asset is in determining how much of that you think you're going to get back. Can the 75, you know, can the, let's say, for example, we get go into a benign Goldilocks scenario and everything turns out wonderfully. Does the 75 go to 100 or does it go to 150? The point is, it can never go to more, but depending on what the gross asset was, you need to know what your potential upside is, and also your ability to assess how much downside you've got. If you know, if you had it at 80, if the gross value is 80 and you've got it at 75, it's a very different asset than if you've, if the gross value is 100 and you've got it at 75.
Contractual might work for regular loans, but what about zero coupon bonds? Is it then a contractual amount of principal, or is it some sort of notion of amortized cost based upon the origination of the asset?
I'd have the future growth. So zero coupon bond, I want to know what the ultimate amount I'm going to get paid is, and I'd like to know what the maturity is.
Ted, are you indifferent, irrespective of whether you originated the loan or whether you purchased it?
So my personal view is I think they are different things. I mean, I think an originated loan is more like an operating asset. I think a purchase loan is always a financial instrument. Because, you know, if I've originated it, you know, it's quite likely I've got some other relationships with that customer, if it, whether it's current accounts or other advisory relationships or anything like that. So you have a much better, on average, you have a much better understanding of an originated book, I think, than a purchased book. And I think that creates enough differentiation. I'd like to see the split between that, but do I still need the same information of what the gross receivable is in both cases, and an idea about duration and maturity? Yes, I would.
But I think for purchase, we were talking about business combinations as well, weren't we? We weren't just talking about acquiring individual loans or portfolios.
So it's a business combination which has been originated. Again, I'd like to know, well, what proportion of that has been originated by the entity that you've acquired, where they, and what proportion of you that you've bought was stuff that they purchased. Because again, if you've bought that entity, you've presumably bought that management team who were involved in the origination and understand the book. But I think in all cases, whether you purchased it or originated it, I still want to know what the gross values are.
We've, when it comes to financial instruments, we've said, you know, we want to know what the gross value is anyway on all of them. So this is no different than, you know, if you do a swap or you do a derivative, we want to know the fair value, and we want to, no, I probably shouldn't use that word, but that we want to know the fair value, and we want to know the notional amount. And I think this is the same thought process. We want to know the notional amount. You know, you said it, you started out by saying it. You know, it's 75 because part of it's an impairment and part of it's an interest rate change. And then the second piece is what Jed said is it's originated is different than bought because of the relationship.
Would you want that for loans or for all debt instruments? So I'm thinking of bonds.
I can't see why you wouldn't want it for bonds. I don't see that there's a difference between the two as such.
So if I buy a bond today that's currently rated double B, it might have been something very different when it was originated. Mm-hmm. Is information about what it was like when it was originated relevant, or is it just the fact that you bought a double B bond for whatever price?
You don't necessarily need information about what it was like when it was originated, but you do need the basic information that will give you an idea as to the path that it could follow from here on. So if you're originating a loan, essentially what you're trying to do as a bank is get paid, and you will build into your loan pricing the margins that you need to cover your operations to make a profit, pay dividends, shareholders and all that sort of thing. But your downside risk is not getting paid. So your whole operation on that loan is to make sure that you do get paid, and if you can't get paid in full, you get paid as much as possible. Whereas when you're buying a credit-impaired loan, your whole point is to try and get paid more than the market thought was possible. That's how you're going to make your money. If we assume it's sort of, you know, priced fairly, so you'll buy it at 75 and you think you've got bigger guys in dinner jackets or more ready access to motorway sort of building sites, and therefore you can collect more money over the next few years than the average punter. So that's your sort of business strategy. So there's a very different thing going on. But in both cases, what you need to know is you need to know, if you like, the ultimate collectible amount and then where you are at that particular point.
I think there might be an aggregation point as well, that say you're thinking about Greek sovereign debt, some of which starts off as held to maturity, a lot of it's held to maturity, some of it's traded. You sort of want to be able to know, as an asset class, where that's come from and where it's going and how much has been written down so far overall. So if you've got where you've got some maybe opacity in a great big bundle of them, you can sort of judge, well, you know, we don't, whether there are not enough impairments being taken. Just judging it across the piece. Maybe something one gets from regulatory data, but...
I thought the point Jed made as well about sort of M&A transactions, because the big problem with M&A generally is an awful lot of stuff gets lost in the wash, and this seems to me to be a classic scenario where that can happen. And having some sort of insight into, okay, I bought a business, and within that business they have stuff they originated and stuff they bought, so that when they then consolidate all of that, I still get a sense of somebody originated this, so it's being managed on a sort of an originated basis, and somebody went out and bought this on a credit impaired basis, and it's being run for sort of upside. That seems to me to be quite important information.
I wonder if it would be interesting for us to know as well what the P&L component of the financial instrument is. So. Suppose you have this bucket of financial instruments, and it's the book value is 100 million. I'd be really interested if the interest income on those instruments is 3 million or 15 million. If you then go to the P&L, usually there's so many elements in the interest income that you wouldn't be able to isolate the interest income. So and for my assessment of how conservative or how aggressive the financial instruments is in the books, I think it would be interesting to know specifically the yield of the financial instruments. So, as in addition to the gross book value,
this is specifically for purchased loans, and or generally an analysis for.
Typically, for companies where financial instruments really is a material part of the balance sheet, there are many other elements that produce interest income or interest costs. So, I think it would be a value to know the interest income that relates to the financial asset.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear, of course.
So the question really is this downward transfer notion. That's really the question, what you're saying. If you really want that disclosure to know if a company B purchases something from company A and there's an impaired portfolio, for instance, to know that in company A was a different value than in company B, even if at that time, for company B, it's 100%, I mean, it's face value again.
Yeah.
Right. I think companies should disclose that, obviously. Because you most of the time you want to know why a company has purchased a bond portfolio from someone else.
So are you okay? Do you want to be able to have to see the same
information
ratio on both
excuse
of
me?
Do you want the same ratio on both of those banks, or are you okay just knowing that the reason this bank has a different ratio is because it purchased and it's now at fair value?
But usually it's going to be implicitly a different ratio because you're purchasing from a different something that was a different value before. I mean, it was what Steve was saying, you're buying something B plus. Used to be a minus already, it's an impaired bond or bond portfolio there, and there's a reason for that. Maybe that's your business, or you think now the company or whoever issued the bond is going to have a better performance. Doesn't really matter, but you want to know the information.
So the comparability isn't so much an issue for you. It's just I want to know what the gross amount is, and
yeah, I mean you want to call the gross amount. Yeah, I would say yeah. I mean to know what happened there. I mean because otherwise the question is going to be why my bank or my institution or whoever an institution I'm analyzing is purchasing that, or why is B plus and you buy something else?
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
I'm dragging something up from the depths of my memory, is it? 3 or 4 years ago, but there were some comments, I think, when the Fed were doing the first set of stress testing on the US banks, and they obviously started with, there was quite a bit of criticism, I think, about financial instrument accounting by the Fed, saying, the problem with all this, we've seen consolidation, people buying books, moving them to fair value, we can't disaggregate what's going on. And if you're stress testing and assuming loss rates on mortgage books or whatever, having this mishmash of stuff that was at fair value versus stuff that was originated and is still a part, you cannot stress test and get to common understanding of how much equity gets wiped out in a bad scenario. And that's why we need the gross amounts, ideally things like duration, data about yield on the different components of the loan book, because it's only an understanding of the underlying contractual nature of the instruments that you've got can you determine what a stress scenario looks like. If all you've got is a series of fair values, you've no idea.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but going back to what Jed just said and Martin, the way I think about it, especially for financial instruments and banks, the market is cyclical. And occasionally, you see it over and over again that banks are either putting things in the reserves or the earnings for the last three quarters are being released of reserves. So, and then at some point you want to step back and be able to think about what's organic income generation, what is associated with the entity's own underwritings, what may be associated with something else. It's a combination of balance sheet and income statement disaggregation, if you will. So if I purchased a portfolio of assets, right? Goldman Sachs went out and bought a bunch of AIG loans, right? And then 2 years from now, the market becomes really, really good. Do I want to understand how much of the release in reserves is associated with kind of organic, some things they have reserved in the past, versus some windfall associated, not windfall, but very, very smart business decision associated with the acquisition of the AIG portfolio? Absolutely. Now, how you get there to the accounting mnemonics, I think it's up to you, but from a user's perspective, I think this is critical. One way to get there is showing the gross versus net and some analysis of those amounts, right? And from my perspective, I think, especially when I see reserve releases and other things, it masks the entire income statement of financial institution. And deciphering that and providing information that allows us to do it is key.
Okay, sounds like support for the sort of things you're working towards. We had considered whether the gross up should appear on the face of the balance sheet, but rejected that in the favor of sort of more comprehensive information being provided in the notes. Mm. Any other points on this? Any other questions you want to particularly raise? There were some other things within the paper.
Yes. I think maybe question two. Originally when we were developing this model, we had three buckets, and all three buckets were going to be on deterioration. So you'd start in bucket one, you'd deteriorate into bucket two, and then you deteriorate into bucket three. Now we've decided that the model will actually work where everything, generally speaking, starts in bucket one, and then it deteriorates and either goes into bucket two or three. And so I'm interested to understand if you think that having those two buckets and the difference between them, or the differentiation between them being on the unit of evaluation, if that's helpful to you, or if not. I mean, they're both measured at a lifetime expected loss.
Yeah. Stuff will still go, quite a lot of stuff will still go bucket one, bucket two, bucket three.
No.
So once something's gone into bucket two, it can't go into bucket three, even if it starts, because it's being... You've got a situation where you've got a book of loans in a town where the main employer's just gone bankrupt. So you know that a lot of that's going to go bad. You stick them all in bucket two immediately and make a lifetime provision. You then, as individually people lose their jobs or things go wrong, you're going to start managing that loss on an individual financial asset, but won't they move to bucket three?
Could in that situation.
Okay.
Yes.
So bucket two and bucket three. I mean, bucket two is a step prior to bucket three, not necessarily.
Everything will end in bucket three.
Because at the end, you have to collect the fund.
You can have things that move either from bucket one immediately to bucket
three. Okay.
You can have things that move from bucket one to bucket two to bucket three, but the credit quality of bucket two and three would be similar.
Okay.
It's not that it's a step down because of credit quality. Okay. It's a you start here and then you split one of these two ways. And is that split helpful to you to have assets that are evaluated in a group versus assets that are evaluated individually, and they're all measured the same way?
So I'm struggling with the difference between bucket two and bucket three, and trying to match that to what might actually happen. And I know you've said that some organizations are such that they will never have a bucket two, that everything goes directly into bucket three. But the way I understand it now, which is clearly wrong, but it's useful because that's the first cut at what somebody might understand this. One is fine. Two, it's exactly what my perception is exactly what is. In this pile of things, I know there's a certain percentage are wrong, and that's bucket two. And then things have gotten the way I interpret this, and I know it's wrong, but the way I interpret this is okay. Now it's not just of the five loans, and let's think corporate loans for a second instead of housing. I did five corporate loans. I'm pretty sure one of them is going to go bad, but I'm not sure one. I know that two are going bad, and I've moved them into bucket three. So I'm still going one, two, three, and I know you guys are saying they're not. And so what have I missed? And what is probably a bunch of other people missed?
The distinction is between managing on a portfolio and managing individually. So you can have good loans in bucket one. Then one of them goes bad, one of your companies, in the example you've given, you can put it straight into bucket three.
But you could put individual loans into bucket two because you're saying this is just, I know this one's going bad and it's probably credit impaired, so I'm going to make a provision, but I'm going to put it in bucket two because it's part of the workout group that is looking at it as a portfolio.
Not if it's managed by itself, it would go into bucket three. And that's the question Sarah is asking, is that useful information that you know? These are each getting provisions exactly the same. Lifetime expected losses, bucket two and bucket three. So there's no difference in the provision. The difference is one bucket two are being managed on a portfolio basis, bucket three are being managed individually. And the question is that useful information to the user?
We've got gross amounts, so we can see what the gap between effectively the loan loss.
Correct me if I'm wrong. In bucket two, not all the loans have been recognized as bad, whereas in bucket three, every single loan is bad. So how come bucket three isn't automatically worse credit? That's the piece I missed.
But I think as a user, I think for me, bucket three will be right away worse than bucket two. If already I've been able to sort out some of the loans from the bucket two and put them in bucket three because I know they are going to go raw. They went raw already. Already, I think to me, I would say, well, these loans are already worse than the ones in bucket two. I mean, take a sector. You put most of the loans of a sector in bucket two, and you sort out two loans and you put them in bucket three already because you really think that the credit quality is worse.
Think about the comparison between banks. So let's say you've got two banks with similar books of business. So we're going to remove the variability of one has mortgages, one has commercial unsecured loans. So it's similar books of business. You're going to look at what's the difference between contractual value and what they've marked it to. So how big that gap is across the various banks. So you can see who's being theoretically slightly more conservative than the other and how that's moving over time. And the same with bucket two. So I think in terms of comparability, keeping separation between bucket two and bucket three will be useful.
Yeah.
Particularly as that on average bucket three is going to be worse. The other thing is there are costs associated with this as well. When we're looking at cost income ratios and data about trends in what's happened to banks' cost base, you know, this is a costly process managing books that are doing badly. And I imagine bucket three is more costly per pound of asset that you've got in there than bucket two. So in terms of projecting P&Ls, understanding that dynamic would be useful.
I think the notion that you're bringing up that you would regard bucket three as worse than bucket two is actually quite probably a useful notion as to why the distinction's useful.
On average,
yeah, and I think it's a reasonable point.
Martin?
Yeah,
Something I would worry about is that first a set of bonds or loans moves into bucket two. So they immediately, there's a loss because basically they're priced a little bit overpriced when they're in bucket one, because they only you only incur a loss, you only take into account a loss. You recognize the loss. And what happens if you then pick out the five bad loans from bucket two, move them in bucket three? Can you move back the bonds to bucket one? And that's kind of construction. That's something I would worry about. So I would propose more or less that if you move a bond or a set of bonds into bucket two, they're no longer allowed to move into bucket three. Keep them in bucket two because you analyze them as a whole and you keep them in bucket two. So no transition between bucket one, two and three.
Within
that,
back to bucket one?
Oh, yeah, you can go. I mean, that's the principle of this whole
reasonable people could reasonably disagree, and I disagree, because I think I finally got my head around, okay, we have bucket one, and then we have relatively large bucket twos, because 10 loans, only two are going to go bad, or only whatever it is. And then we have this relatively small bucket three that is really bad. If you get your wish, then I've got bucket two is no longer being managed as a portfolio. It includes things I've known that have gone bad that really should be bucket three. So, and I don't have the problem of I've got three loans. I've got this bucket. I've got bucket two, and I've now been able to figure out which are the ones that are going bad, and I've moved them out. And then the cleansed bucket two is now. I'm pretty sure there's nothing bad about it. I have no problem about letting it float back to bucket. In fact, I'd like it to go back to bucket one.
Well, the other thing is, if you price the portfolio correctly, it should be value. That event should be value neutral, because you're putting stuff back into bucket one, which is theoretically on average getting a write up. But similarly, the stuff you've moved to bucket three is getting a write down, because in aggregate, the fair value of the new bucket three plus the bucket one should be the same as the original portfolio that was in bucket two.
But part of the concern on this is we had one of the large European banks in that said, we evaluate every single individual loan separately. We credit score every car loan, every mortgage, every corporate loan. So we would have zero in bucket two. And their concern is sort of similar to some of the things you've been saying, that they would be perceived to be a worse bank than somebody that doesn't have the systems and has to evaluate on.
I think that won't be the case, because you will, I don't need sort of format for disclosure, but I would assume that you would see a very clear sort of, you know, here's the bucket one large number, here's the bucket two very, very small number, here's bucket three very big, and then you'll compare to another European bank and see completely inverted relationship compared to the first bank, and then you'll ask questions, and one of the things they'll have to explain to the market is, well, this is what we do, and this is why bucket two is so small.
I think just using maybe the numbers is categorizing that. Maybe you eliminate the numbers instead of two or three, because I understand what you're saying. I hope I'm going to find a bank. So you eliminate two and three, you know, maybe, you know, you put, I don't know, something else, individual loans, and and portfolio or something like that. Maybe eliminate, you know, categorizing right away, because I have said as a user, I tend to categorize right away as soon as you say two and three.
I agree. I think that's a risk.
Show the reserves, that's a risk. Provisions against, and the provisions on very large three will be very small, and that will show a completely different picture than large provisions on large bucket three for another institution.
If the two comparisons are doing it correctly, we would see it right away. The bank that sort of manages on a portfolio, they'd have a big bucket two and a small bucket three. The other bank would have a larger bucket three. They would be taking the same relative provisions if they're doing all the calculations correctly. And if that bank is really doing what they're saying, they're going to have a lot less bad loans. They're going to have a lot less in bucket two and bucket three than their competitors. Because the bucket two, there are good loans in bucket two. That's the problem. There's a bunch of good stuff in there that you just don't know. It's a red herring.
Okay.
No, I was going to say, if I understand, it's not a matter they are good or they are bad. It's a matter of whether there is a portfolio with individual loan. So then, you know, we eliminate good and bad. But I think putting two and three is what it makes us as user, or at least to me, thinking there might be different levels. That's my only comment. I understand what you were saying, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with being a portfolio or just being individuals. So maybe, you know, have to put something makes things even in that sense.
Is the question whether... Well, okay, so the issue that you've got with moving to your new definitions of buckets, where you're just saying how they're managed, is the complexity in the old version that large European bank would have been relaxed about it because they could have said, yes, I can differentiate bucket one, bucket two, bucket three on quality, but I manage them in aggregate. But it seems to me, you know, every bank individually credit scores every customer.
Well,
does that...
Not necessarily.
Well, I'd be surprised. I mean, everyone's got a credit score.
At inception, but not necessarily following through in life.
Yeah. Credit score on the day you take the loan.
And then they don't continue to track it. Well, that's useful information. Which banks do that?
Okay, let's draw this to a close, shall we? Hope that's
Can I ask
useful?
One question on assuming there's going to be a transfer from bucket two or three back to bucket one, there's going to be mandatory types of disclosure, I assume.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
If there are transfers from buckets three or two back to one, there are going to be required disclosures about the amount transferred back into the different buckets, between the different buckets.
We haven't worked on the disclosures yet, but that would definitely be something the staff would recommend anyway.
And then we're back to your question one.
Yeah.
Gross amount.
And sorry, and can we also see whether they've been originated or purchased? Because if I'm buying stuff that's effectively, I'm counting in bucket two and making a lifetime provision of you, or effectively fair valuing it, and saying that's a lifetime provision, and then I say, okay, now I don't think it's going to go bad, I'm going to put it in bucket one, you can generate quite a lot of profit quite quickly that way.
Go on, Rob. Last question.
I was going to explain why it was so important to have those two, because it changes the calculation on the valuation and the reproducibility because if you've gone from bucket two to bucket one because the economy's changed, you can't do that every year. Whereas if the money's really coming from your origination, you could do that year in, year out. And I think that's why it's important. We've timed out.
Okay, you have Sarah and Catherine's email addresses on the staff paper. If you have any further disclosure requests or any other comments, then just list them and I'm sure they'll be happy to take them. Okay, thanks, both of you. Should we have a 10-minute break?